Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, 25 years in 25 days, 2001.
You know, if there's a pothole or you don't get rid of the first 3 inches of snow, they want to impeach you. But if there's a train wreck or a blackout, or they just rise to the occasion. And the people of New York really did rise to the occasion.
On 9/11, we will ask for your calls on what hasn't changed since 9/11 in New York City. And for you newer New Yorkers who have come since, why did you move to a city with a bullseye on its back? That's later. Also today, the Republican candidate for governor of New York, Rob Astorino. But first, last night, I moderated a forum, as many of you know, at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark, looking at the Affordable Care Act's first year in the city and in the state of New Jersey. It was a 90-minute event sponsored by the Healthcare Foundation of New Jersey, and we had a great crowd. Sold it out, sold out a free event. Haha, that's easy. To hear about how Obamacare's rollout, and to tell us how Obamacare's rollout is playing across the state. And we're going to play some excerpts here. Kai Wright, reporting fellow of the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, has been following this story for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio this year. He was my radio partner on the panel last night, along with the guests that we invited. And Kai Wright joins me in the studio right now. Good morning, Kai.
Good morning.
And listeners, we can open the phones for people to share some of your own Obamacare experience as well, 212-433-9692. But before we get into the healthcare weeds here, the first clip I want to play, Kai, and I don't know if you want to say anything about this in advance, is the exchange that you had with filmmaker Byron Hurt. We talked about his award-winning documentary, Soul Food Junkies, and what inspired him to make the film. And as we will hear, you had a similar story to share. These stories are about your fathers.
Yeah, I think, you know, for a lot of folks in the Black community in particular, health and health care is a deeply personal and deeply resonant issue. We've watched a lot of people die needlessly early in our families, and it's motivated a number of us professionally, and I think that's what Byron talks about.
So the first voice in this clip, filmmaker Byron Hurt, director of Soul Food Junkies.
Well, my film Soul Food Junkies was inspired by my father, who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2004. And I saw firsthand him sort of struggle with insurance companies around making sure that he was covered because they were trying to claim that he had a pre-existing condition, and so he may not be covered for his treatment, his cancer treatment. So I saw the amount of stress that it caused my father to try and figure out whether or not he was going to have the coverage that he needed without the family going bankrupt. But his struggle with his diet and his lifestyle, and then eventually this cancer, is what led me to make my film Soul Food Junkies. And the film was really about trying to take a look at the ways in which we could sort of prevent many of the nutritional-related illnesses that many African-American and people of color face around the country. One of the things that I realized early on when I was doing research on my film was that African-American people, men and women, as well as Latino people, had the highest rates of just about everything across the board, right, in terms of nutritional-related illnesses, from cancer to diabetes to hypertension, heart disease, all of the various nutritional illnesses. And so I became really curious as to why. Why is that? Why are people of color suffering at such incredible rates? And then I also saw, on a very personal level, my father really struggled with making the kind of diet changes, lifestyle changes, that he wanted to make, but he was really emotionally connected to the food that he loved to eat, and he had a really difficult time giving those foods up. And then it also challenges the lack of access to high-quality food in communities of color, And also the systemic racism, institutional racism, and classism that exists that makes it very difficult and very challenging for people of color who live in certain areas, certain communities around the nation to have access to quality food. So that's really, but my father's struggle with his own health is what led me to make the documentary.
And access to quality, a lot of stuff. And places like Newark, to be very specific, you know, I mean, part of why we invited Byron to be part of the conversation here is it's very easy for these discussions to become about numbers and about health policy. The story Brian was mentioning about my father is that, you know, I became a health reporter in part because of watching my father's health, who was a doctor, whose job it was to help working class and poor black people not die from diabetes and heart disease too early, and he died at 58 from diabetes and heart disease. And there's a communal and an individual frustration with that. It's like wrestling with water sometimes, it feels, as an individual and then as a community. And then along comes something like the Affordable Care Act, and I think our question then is, are we now more empowered in that fight? Are we not? Byron, what is the answer to that?
Well, I don't know if I have the answer to it. I do know that people want to be healthy. I do know that people want access to healthier foods in their neighborhoods, in their community. I think people are really kind of struggling with their daily lives and all of the different things that are taking place that make their health and make their wellness lower on the list of priorities. But I think the Affordable Health Care Act, I think, really opens the door for people to have the kind of access that they ought to have.
So filmmaker Byron Hurt there, who made the movie Soul Food Junkies, a documentary, and Kai Wright, our healthcare correspondent, who was with me to do the NJ PAC event last night on 1 year of Obamacare, the 1 year checkup, as we called it, in Newark and the state of New Jersey. And I want to lead you to what you said right after that, or even to set up that exchange with you and Byron Hurt, because that was so personal. It wasn't obviously about the Affordable Care Act. It was about your father's and lifestyle. And, you know, you heard the gasp. I already knew the story, so I had already gasped. But you heard the gasp from the audience when you said your father was a doctor who was helping people fight diabetes and bad diet that leads to it. And he still had the same struggle himself and died from it at 58. So where does the Affordable Care Act intersect with that?
Well, one, this stuff is really, really hard. It's the point of those stories. This is really complicated stuff that is going to go beyond just a piece of public policy. But what the Affordable Care Act does is open the door. So, you know, there's folks like my father and Byron's father had health insurance. They were the best case scenario. What the Affordable Care Act is doing is engaging the folks who are not the best case scenario. One of the things that we've forgotten that we don't talk about with this law is this is a massive poverty program. This is one of the largest poverty programs we've seen since 1965. Something like 15 million people, mostly low income, are now insured who were not a year ago. And so that is going to open the door for an opportunity to change these things, to give people a little more power in that wrestling with water that I was talking about. Or it may not. We'll see. But that's the idea.
And I was talking about this in another context on the show just the other day, how history may remember Barack Obama if the Affordable Care Act sticks and works as the president who got the essential anti-poverty program of his generation through, the first really significant one since, you know, the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson 50 years ago. And the number of Americans, and as you were suggesting, the disproportionately number of African Americans who get bankrupted and financially ruined by health care costs was becoming a real problem in this country. And this is his attempt to fix it, even though, as you said on the stage last night, neither party really wants to call it that.
Nobody has any interest in talking about it from that perspective. But that is what it is. It's the biggest thing we've seen since the earned income tax credit, at least, and arguably since LBJ.
So later in the event, we opened the floor to questions from the audience, and we met a woman named Faraha. She told us that she was a veteran healthcare professional and that she was involved with coordinating navigators in communities around New Jersey during last year's open enrollment period. Remember, navigators are people who help potential enrollees navigate the sign-up process, and she saw some really, really serious flaws and omissions with what was available. So listen to Faraha, who spoke from the audience.
I've been very disappointed with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act in New Jersey, and particularly in the city of Newark, considering that we've also put in a lot of work to prepare to facilitate the services on a level where people could be properly served. And we have personally reached out to our local organizations and political leaders, and felt very disheartened by the result and the interaction that we had gotten or not received on a community level.
Can you get specific about what about the rollout isn't going well?
Well, I think that, first of all, there was not proper education of the enrollers, which I think made it a lot more difficult for those individuals who were expected to purchase insurance. That's one level of it. The other level is the proper education for those individuals who were expected to purchase insurance and how they were better educated and prepared to buy something that they actually knew nothing about. So there was not enough, I don't think, organization and collaboration on the community level to make this effort more successful.
So is that to say not as many people as could have bought policies, or also that people bought the wrong policies for them? What would you say?
I think it could be a combination of both. And I know that while there were organizations who received funding that were supposed to be much more instrumental in the city or in New Jersey in general, that why that disconnect was there amongst these individuals who were supposed to be serviced and those individuals being more accessible to help, that's a mystery to me. But I do know we were over capacity, and we were very much over the ability of the amount of people that we could help, because there was not that amount of, I guess I would say, collaboration on the organizational level. So how we were able to help people in the short time that we were able to do it, well, thankfully there were a few churches that allowed us to come in and do educational and enrollment events. But as far as the support that we received to help the community, we ended up
from the state.
We ended up working with people that actually came as far as South Jersey, not even in our immediate county, but the savior for us was that there were organizations who got it and said, hey, we're going to send people and we're going to roll up our sleeves that are going to help you to enroll these people. And so other than that, when we talk about maybe the response or the way people are interacting with the Affordable Care Act or with the exchanges, I think that the lack of coordination is more so on the organizational level than it is within the people. And I think people get tired and fed up with showing up and not getting the results that they're entitled to.
Faraha, one of the healthcare professionals who turned up in the audience and spoke at the microphone during our NJPAC event last night, the Obamacare one-year checkup for Newark and New Jersey, done with our health correspondent Kai Wright for this project, also with the Nation Institute and Color Lines. So, Kai, she really raised a number of interesting issues, and you've been talking to folks in Newark for much of the year. We've aired some of your reporting. We'll be airing more early next month. How much did she reflect what you've been hearing, especially, I think, about the complexity of the process?
A great deal. So first off, I should say that, you know, when you talk to most folks like her who have been working on the ground of this, they are extremely proud of what they accomplished in the first open enrollment period. 161,000 people in New Jersey signed up. That was a big number.
And can we linger on that for a second? Go off in a little tangent here, because that was the first thing you said from the stage last night, that if we are going to judge success or failure of Obamacare year one in New Jersey, the first word is unbelievable success in as measured by the amount to which the number of uninsured people and percentage of uninsured people in the state went down.
It cut in half. that insurance rate was cut in half in 1 year's time. And so if it's just getting the card on by that straightforward measure, it's this out of the ballpark success so far. I think one of the things you hear in FRA is that, first off, how folks feel like they did a good job in spite of the conditions in which they had to work, right? That there were not enough resources available there, and the process is really complicated. And it's not just about the glitches on healthcare.gov, right? We talked a lot about that, but these plans are really complicated. Some argue by design to figure out a really consequential choice. And so navigators found themselves thinking they were going to spend 45 minutes on signing someone up, spending 2 hours on signing someone up. That processes that they thought could be finished in one meeting would take multiple meetings, and there just weren't enough people to do it. And it's going to be harder this year because there's going to be fewer resources and there's going to be less motivated consumers.
Right. The low-hanging fruit, if we want to call people that, of those who were pretty anxious to sign up for...
That first half is in. The second half is going to be a lot harder.
So speaking of signing people up, here's another exchange from last night. We had an insurance executive with us, Larry Altman, Vice President of the Strategic Initiatives Group at Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, the state's largest health insurer, and he oversees their Office of Health Reform. So I'm going to play an exchange that mostly I had with him, and this starts with my question. I actually want to follow up, Larry, with a question about a trend that I've heard coming from the insurance companies, and see what you have to say about it, that there's a movement from co-pays to co-insurance, that people are being asked to pay, instead of the flat $10 co-pay, co-insurance, which would be a percentage, which I think in many cases is going to wind up being more out of pocket for each visit, and that it may not have been clear on the exchange as much as it could have been which policies have co-pays, which policies have co-insurance, and that there was maybe a very small difference, like $10 a month or something, in the cost of the premium, for people to save a lot of money in that distinction. Is this an important emerging story?
The whole role we all play as consumers, which we don't usually think of ourselves as consumers if we're using health care when it comes to our health. And in some ways, maybe it's better not to, because it's not like a product you buy and sell. But in the other ways, I think part of what we are as a society, I think, need to move toward is all of us becoming more educated and informed, patients or consumers or whatever you want to call it, but just being more involved. And so one example you point out is how some of the complexities of the product and people may not have fully understood them, which I think is probably accurate. I think the specifics or maybe stepping a little bit back from the specifics of co-pays versus co-payments versus co-insurance is the idea, which there's been this trend, and I'd say will continue, is that more and more of the cost of healthcare, even for people that have health insurance, is being passed on to the consumer or the patient. So why is that? It's because the more cost is passed on to the consumer, the lower the premium. There's a kind of a direct relationship between how much is covered by health insurance and what the cost of the premium is. So the reason that some health insurance companies, including Horizon in some cases, offer a range of products, including some that, you're right, for a service might charge a percentage, that's the co-insurance percentage, as opposed to a flat dollar amount, is basically to pass more of that cost on to the consumers and have consumers feel, basically be more engaged consumers. So let me give one example. We've certainly heard from customers, and I felt it myself as a patient. When you go to get a prescription filled, I think many of us got used to, when you go to get a drug at the pharmacy, it costs $5 or $10, right? That's the copayment at the drugstore. Well, the average drug that people are taking costs a lot more than $5 or $10. Frankly, it costs a lot more than $40 or $50. But I think the idea of having the patients, the consumers, be more engaged and have more of a sense of what things cost in the healthcare system is, I think, a growing trend, and I think we will see more of it. Now, you make up an important point about people maybe not understanding it, and that, I'd say, falls on the insurance companies to address that through better education, which we try to do out in the public, in the community, online, on the phone, and for the exchange itself. I actually was on healthcare.gov today. It's not open for the new enrollment, but I was looking at the products and just in kind of preparation for tonight. And it does. There are co-payments, there are co-insurances listed. There's maximum out-of-pockets. There's deductibles. There's in-network and out-of-network maximum out-of-pocket. So it does get complicated pretty quickly. And to the point that there's not a lot of information. There's a lot to digest to make informed choices.
Larry Altman from Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield at our NJ PAC Obamacare at 1 year event last night. Beautiful facility, by the way, NJ PAC. If you haven't been there, go to downtown Newark if you haven't been there in a while. They've got all kinds of things in halls, big and small, of all kinds of music and stuff. So I'll put in a little personal plug, having been there a few times in the last year now, for NJ PAC. But after that exchange with Larry Altman, when he talked about engaged consumers and how you really have to pay attention at a pretty granular level of detail just to have health insurance, even if you have health insurance, that kind of got the audience riled up, a number of people in the audience riled up. And it was, again, part of this theme of complexity that seemed to emerge from the night that I think Kai and I were not expecting necessarily. So when we opened the floor back up to questions, we eventually heard from Maplewood resident Jolie, who's had serious health problems and has a child who's had serious health problems. And she is both grateful for and extremely frustrated with the system. And keep in mind that Larry Altman had just urged people to be engaged consumers in their health care lives.
I want to thank Obamacare because it's saving my life right now. But if I had had it 2 years ago, I live in Maplewood, a town that is blissfully ignorant of most of what we're talking about. But I won't be living there in a few days because I'm one of those statistics where 10 years of a chronic illness and my daughter saving her life bankrupted me. Mm-hmm. So after 35 years of building savings and 17 years of paying my mortgage, my house is foreclosed, I'm penniless. The only thing I qualify for is poverty. It's food stamps and Obamacare. And I want to say that navigating it, I'm a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal and Newsweek. I know how to navigate. I know how to ask questions and go up the phone tree for 3 hours. And navigating it is hard for me. And if you're a single mother and you're sick and your kid is sick and you're trying to survive a job where they're going to fire you because they don't give a damn about the Family Leave Medical Care Act, then they can fire you with, because that's a fictional law. How much time do you have to navigate this system? I spent all this time calling my doctors and trying to find out, do you accept the platinum plan under Horizon, to find out if I could actually get those doctors. And it turns out, too, that there's no out-of-network. So, on the mental health issue, there is nothing. I mean, there is nothing barely for people who can spend tons of money. There's people with tons of money waiting lists for pediatric psychiatrists. For people like me, I'm getting the care and my daughter's getting the care only because my doctors are not charging us. And there's no out-of-state. This company said to me, so I just got a $50,000 bill from New York Presbyterian, and my daughter, who's at college in Florida, went to two urgent care places that wouldn't take our card. And the only thing is I can do is laugh because I'm in Chapter 7 bankruptcy, so they're not going to see a penny of it. But I want to tell you, I don't want to be a consumer who's actively doing this. I want to be living my life, taking care of my kid, trying to get back to work if I ever can with my disability. I don't want to spend time choosing between a million plans that don't make anything clear. So thank you, but no thank you.
Wow.
Yep.
The emotional climax of the evening.
Yep.
Really. And I think what that left me with was, if we're going to wind up with a single payer system in this country someday, it's going to be because of stories like that. It's because this is, as I think you said, how did you put it? A patchwork laid on top of a...
It's where we are not remaking the healthcare system here. We are laying a patch on top of an already tattered program, right? Our system is tattered. And I think what you hear in the commenters' voice is that people are already past their breaking point with the existing system. And that has to be paired with the fact that this, if even if this patchwork is going to work, it's going to take a really long time to see the effects. And we just may not have that amount of time. In people's lives and people's communities, we just may not have that amount of time.
Now, listeners, we posted the entire event. If you want to check it out on our website at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. We've been listening to some clips here, and we're going to wrap it up now as we have Rob Astorino, the Republican candidate for governor of New York, standing by. Kai Wright, reporting fellow of the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, has been following this story for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio this year. He was both kind of a panelist, but also my partner as, you know, co-questioner and really correspondent for our healthcare project last night. And again, we thank the Healthcare Foundation of New Jersey for making it possible. Kai, will talk.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehr on WNYC. Rob Astorino is next. Brian Lehr on WNYC. Thanks a lot for listening today. Now the Republican candidate for governor of New York, Rob Astorino, currently in his second term as Westchester County Executive. Welcome back to WNYC, Mr. Astorino. Hi.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Good. You know, I saw the polls that show that one of your big problems is name recognition. Probably a majority of our listeners, I would say, are hearing your voice for the first time right now. So why don't we start at the beginning? Why do you want to be governor of New York?
Because this state is losing badly. You know, the island of Manhattan is doing fairly well, especially if you're very wealthy and connected to the governor and corporate welfare and corporate America. But most people are being left behind. A lot of neighborhoods that I walk around in the Bronx and Brooklyn and Queens and Staten Island are not doing well, and including many neighborhoods in Upper Manhattan where people are struggling. Right now I'm in Syracuse. I'm on my way to Rochester, two of the worst cities in America, according to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, in economic outlook. So the vast majority of the state is doing poorly because the policies are we have the highest taxes in America, the worst business climate, worst state to retire in, highest cost of living as a state, and the most corruption. And the corruption is really, Brian, coloring every decision made right now in Albany. We got a governor who is under federal investigation and may end up being indicted, may end up plea bargaining and losing his governorship, as Elliot Spitzer did, so it's not out of the question. And unfortunately, the very wealthy and the very few are getting ahead. They're doing well. The rest of us are being left behind, and that's the voice I'm representing right now, the vast middle class, the working poor, who cannot move forward in this state right now.
But if you're going to come on with something akin to a 99% line, usually the people who identify with that line don't want to cut taxes and lower government spending, as I think is at the heart of your economic program.
Well, we see what happens in New York. If we're the highest tax state in America, highest tax city in America, then why don't we just double the taxes and that should make us great, right? It's not. It's why businesses are leaving. It's why unemployment is unacceptably high. It's why people can't find a good paying job. And, you know, I live in the highest tax county in America, and we cut taxes, and the economy rebounded. We actually have 30,000 new private sector jobs. So tell that to the people who were unemployed, who are now working a good job, if they think that policy worked. It did. But that doesn't mean it came at the expense of services. In fact, we work with our nonprofits. We work with United Black Clergy and Latino leaders to make their communities better. Our services are stronger. We actually put more money into getting it into the people who truly need it and got rid of the waste and the overhead, and we're a better county for it. And we got to do that in New York State because, you know, if we're dead last in America in all the categories that actually matter, then why are we content with staying there? We shouldn't be. We've got to make some dramatic moves. And my step, you know, would go forward, and my plan would make us the most competitive in the Northeast, because right now we're not. We're the worst of the worst in all the categories that matter, and we're suffering the consequences. So that's why, Brian, you know, the 99%ers, yeah, I'm one of them. I live that way, but I'm also an opportunity to make sure that our state gets better for the 99%, because the 1%, boy, are they doing real well under Andrew Cuomo with their $25,000 and $50,000 campaign checks. and then the tax credits and the breaks and the winks and the nod and the corruption that they get under this governor. It's what Zephyr Teachout was talking about, and I agree. You know, she and I agreed on the most fundamental issue that affects this state, and that's the corruption.
Listeners, if you want to call in and talk to Rob Astorino, Republican candidate for governor of New York, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. But when you talk about the corruption, people on the left wind up with public campaign financing as the solution to that, that what the corruption really is not developers handing bribes under the table to politicians, the kind of corruption that got people arrested recently in the state, you know, that we've all heard about. But what the Moreland Commission was really aiming at seemed more to be the legal corruption, the influence of money in the system. And Governor Cuomo embraced the idea, at least, of public campaign financing. It couldn't get through the state Senate. And usually Republicans oppose it. That's why it couldn't get through the state Senate. What's your position on that? And do you think that would get at the heart of the corruption in New York State?
Please. Andrew Cuomo has not embraced anything unless it benefits him. I mean, you can't sit there and pretend to be for public financing, not work to actually get it in place, because he's benefiting off this system. He has $50,000 Brian, this is an interesting thing, okay? He has 81% of his donations are $10,000 or more. Public financing also requires debates, which he chooses to not do any one-on-one debates with me. One local debate in Buffalo on PBS, it's basically a local debate with all of the candidates, which is what he said was a disservice to democracy and why he refused to debate Zephyr Teachout. Wouldn't even shake her hand, wouldn't show her any respect. It's why I did debate her, because the issues, though we may disagree on, fundamentally we agree on the corruption issue. I think what's more important than anything, because money is always going to find its way. There's no perfect system. And public financing, by the way, has not proven to be the answer either. It's taking public money, giving it to politicians, some of whom are corrupt, and letting them spend it on robocalls and negative attack ads. When ask Jonathan Liu how well public financing worked. Ask Malcolm Smith, you know, so I don't think that there's a perfect solution. What I do think is more important than anything is transparency. This governor has been the least transparent in history. What I would allow and what I think is very important, and part of my ethics plan, by the way, is term limits. I think we need term limits. I think we also need to strip away the pensions of public officials who are convicted of corruption. But transparency, Brian, is more important than anything. And that shines a light on the dollars coming in, when it's coming in, who wrote out the checks, and the wink and the nod that they got right before it or right after it, like Extel and other deals in New York City. So I think transparency is more important than anything else.
But the number that I've seen is that Cuomo has a 23-to-1 spending advantage over you. You could tell me if you have a different number, but I'm sure it's something extremely lopsided. I've read 23-to-1. Are you a Citizens United guy? Are you that kind of Republican who thinks that money equals speech? Because otherwise, he's going to have 23-to-1, and maybe they'll disclose more under your plan, you know, who exactly is giving what. But there is an unlevel playing field, because if the big money interest, whether it's corporations or unions or whatever, sees him as the inevitable winner, they're going to throw all their money at him so that they have a piece of him. Would we not be better off doing away or at least trimming the power of that system?
Well, you can't have exemptions. And, you know, the plans that I've seen is, okay, no corporate and, you know, lower the individual, but unions are exempted and others are exempted. You know, that is not an unfair playing field either. But I get back to my original thing. Look, I was outspent 5-to-1. It's not 23-to-1. That's not what we're being outspent. Yes, we're being outspent by large amounts. Yes, he's putting total false advertising against me on TV. Even the New York Times has called him out on that stuff. And he'll continue to do that. We have a governor, really, that has no desire to really communicate with the public, no transparency, no morals and ethics. That's another story. And yeah, we're being outspent. But I was outspent tremendously in my race for county executive. We were down in the polls, 30 points on Labor Day, and I won by 13 in Deep Blue Westchester because, as the New York Times article proved yesterday, Democrats supported me in Westchester because we really turned the economics around. We actually turned the business climate around. We have a healthier county now. We need to do that for New York State. You know, Cuomo is focusing on a couple issues that are purely divisive. It's not going to make this state any better economically. It's not going to put people back to work, including women and minorities. It's going to drive businesses out of this state, as what's been happening. So we can't be surprised by the results if we vote for Cuomo 2.0 and businesses continue to leave New York and the unemployment rate continues to be high and we continue to have the highest, most onerous taxes.
Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Republican candidate for governor of New York, Rob Astorino. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thank you. Hello, Rob. Rob, I'm a moderate Democrat in Brooklyn. I would really like to vote Republican in a gubernatorial election, but, you know, I can't vote for you. I would like to vote Republican because I want lower taxes. I can't afford to pay any more taxes, also property taxes, but I can't vote for you because I really need the Affordable Health Care Act. Dean Skelos, the Republican Senate Majority Leader, and the other Senate Republicans were blocking $50 million from the federal government for New York State to help set up the exchanges. You were blocking it just because you didn't. It was Obamacare, and I have to have affordable health insurance. And I brought this up to my state senator, Republican Marty Golden, at a community meeting. He was bragging how he's going to get more Medicaid for his constituents. And I said, well, you want more Medicaid, but you're blocking $50 million from the feds in order to set up the exchanges. What do you say to that? And he just insulted me. So if you're going to run on a platform and give in to this so-called Tea Party and try to take down the Affordable Health Care Act, I cannot vote for you.
Bob, thank you for your call. What is your relationship with Obamacare?
Well, Bob, Obamacare is here. Obamacare is not going anywhere. And we already have a state exchange. By taking the money from the federal government, as the other states are finding out, that money goes away. That money then becomes the 90% of it has to be funded by local taxes. So, Bob, if you're complaining about taxes now, your taxes are going to go through the roof. We need affordable health care. There's no question. But what's happening in New York State, the insurance rates are going up a projected 20%, Bob. So you're going to – the pressure to move out of the state is going to be even greater if we don't get the expenses in our state budget under control. To pay for the services that we need, we have to look at the budget and taxes, because that's what we did in Westchester. That's why Democrats voted for me in Westchester. And health care is vitally important. But you know what's going to happen here, Bob? We're going to have the super wealthy and we're going to have the super poor all on services. The vast majority, and I think you're in that, as the middle class, are going to be leaving New York in record numbers, as they already have, because you can't afford to live in this state.
Bob, thank you for your call. Let me follow up on that with another question about taxes and services. Cutting education earlier in the Cuomo administration was very unpopular with, you know, probably Democrats and Republicans who are involved in their local school districts, and imposing the local property tax cap that affects education funding is one of the more controversial taxation measures that Cuomo has taken, and that's a limit on taxes. You want to cut more. What effect do you think it would have on local school districts if your tax plan were to be enacted?
Well, what I want to do is cut the income taxes, which are the most onerous in America and the most onerous in New York City. And look, it's not arguable at this point that our onerous taxes are driving people, especially with money, out of New York State. And so, well, there goes all the money to pay for the services that we need. And the burden is getting more and more on the middle class. And those that are being left behind are being left behind. We can't allow that. People need services. We need to make sure that we give an opportunity for those of the working poor, the middle class, to actually be able to stay here. And for those on services, we want to give them the services that they need, but we also want to give them the services and the empowerment to get off of that, to break the generational cycle of poverty. And, you know, so I think there are some things that Bill de Blasio was talking about which are correct. I also think, though, we're going to get back very quickly to the bad habits of the 70s that ruined our city with unrestrained spending. And that's really where the mayor is going. A 7% increase in the budget is extraordinarily high. And I think the governor has to be a check and balance on an agenda that might be well-intentioned, but is going to drive more and more New Yorkers out of New York City and out of New York State.
But
it's a balance that we need in this state, and that's what I'll bring to New York and what I brought to Westchester, it's a healthy balance.
But does history really suggest that that's true in New York State? Our last Republican governor was, of course, George Pataki, who was in for three terms, and he ran on an income tax cut and did get an income tax cut, a state income tax cut, through. But by the end of his 12 years, the people of upstate New York, where the real economic desolation is, did not really feel empowered by that. They were ready to try Eliot Spitzer to, you know, change everything on day one, as Spitzer once said. And that Pataki program of tax cuts and budget deficits did not really work. One could argue that that really wasn't the formula. And one could look at New York City and say, with the highest taxes in the state, you know, there's a boom in the number of billionaires in New York City. And it's only, I think I've read, it's mostly retirees who are the ones who are leaving New York State. It's not so much the job creators.
Well, again, Brian, there's an asterisk on this. The island of Manhattan is doing well. And the island of Manhattan will probably always do well. But get off that one little island and people are struggling mightily. And I know, as you may have followed our public schedule, as the New York Times reported and others, I go where Republicans don't traditionally go. I go to the neighborhoods in Jackson Heights, Queens, and talk to the merchants and talk to the people. I go to the Bronx and Upper Manhattan and talk to the Dominicans and Puerto Ricans. Cuomo's going to the island of Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic to talk to people on the beach. I'm talking to Dominicans and Puerto Ricans in New York City who are struggling, and I'm going to talk in Spanish because I speak it. And there's a very big difference between what Cuomo's New York looks like and what the rest of New York is actually dealing with. And, you know, by the logic of some, let's just double the taxes right now. We're the worst in the country, or the highest, or the best, if that's what some people think. So let's just double it. Shouldn't it be better, twice as good? No, it's going to be twice as worse.
Was Pataki's tax plan successful at creating jobs in New York?
The reason why you can't have tax cuts and not have reductions in expenses, that doesn't work. You need to be responsible, as I was in Westchester. We cut taxes more than any county, but we also inherited a deficit, which we got rid of, and a $1.8 billion budget, which is now $1.7 billion. So we live within our means. We didn't go on a spending spree. If you do that and limit revenue, then clearly you're going to be completely out of balance. And that's what New York has done. And those that don't properly balance their budget and make structural changes, and yes, some hard choices, it's irresponsible to cut taxes.
So what would you cut? Who feels the pain?
Who's feeling the pain? The vast middle class is feeling
the
pain right now.
Who would feel the pain of the government spending cuts that you just promised?
I think corporate America, to some extent. We're giving out almost $2 billion in tax credits. Does anyone really think that the film and TV industry needs a $500 million tax credit from New York State? I don't. They're here. They're successful. They're going to always be here because this is one of the best film locations in the world. So why are we giving tax breaks to an industry that doesn't need it? You know, in Buffalo, Andrew Cuomo is going to spend $750 million for the government to build Solar City, to build the buildings, to bring the infrastructure, to basically run it. That's not what we should be doing for a billionaire who doesn't need that kind of tax break, for 3,000 promised jobs. But we never know if it's going to come to fruition. The tax credits are going away for the solar industry by the federal government anyway. And at a cost of $500,000 per job, I don't think that's a wise investment for a private industry.
Is your tax policy consistent? Because you just said the film industry doesn't need the special tax break that it gets. They would argue that California is sitting in wait to eat their lunch. Vancouver is trying to get, you know, more film production there all the time. And that it is actually an example of tax competition making a difference. And at the same time, you're saying that the income tax cut, which is mostly a cut for the rich, would drive people away if you don't have it.
$200,000 or $100,000 or $50,000 is not the rich in New York, certainly not in the New York metropolitan area. They need a tax break. There is no question about it. Every family I talk to, they can't afford it anymore, whether it's suburbia, whether it's people in New York City with children. It's very hard these days. And I hear that. I know that. But some of these corporate giveaways, that's not the answer. You know, California and New York are two of the bottom feeders in America. We're ranked 50th in America. We can't even compete against the Northeast. We've got to be more competitive. And, you know, to sit here and to say that we need higher taxes or more government spending, that is the worst solution right now, because the Texas and the Floridas and the Carolinas, they made a conscious decision several years ago to tackle the biggest impediments. We have not done that here. You know, Andrew Cuomo is living off a headline, but nobody is feeling it whatsoever. And we got to make some tough decisions. But government right now is doing things we shouldn't be doing, like handing out checks to corporate America left and right. Right. And I'm not saying that there is not some room for tax incentives. There are. But right now we're backwards. We're trying to offer tax incentives when we have the policies that are really driving everybody out.
But also, that's
if we fix these policies, then tax incentives can come later on to compete. But we got to fix the policies out of Albany right now.
One other thing on this. That's small potatoes, isn't it? Looking at corporate tax breaks targeted by industry like the film industry. If you're talking about a big cut in state revenue that would come from an across-the-board income tax cut, the state is more or less in the business of education and health care. And so isn't that where the big cuts would have to come and people would feel that?
I don't think cuts. I think you need to prioritize. You also, look, one of the suggestions I have said is since New York City and since the counties all have to contribute, and this is one of the only states that forced this, have to contribute to the expenses, then they should have the decision-making power as well. I would allow each county to basically set their own priorities on services, on eligibility that meets the federal requirements. But for instance, if New York City wants to be overly generous and expand eligibility, that's okay. That's their policy decision. But New York City has to pay for that. That's a policy decision. If, you know, upstate Cayuga County or Onondaga County wants to limit some benefits and make some changes, that should be their decision too, because they're paying for it. And I think that's an area we got to look at. I also think, you know, on long-term care, which is expensive, I think we've got to prioritize. We also got to incentivize where a parent can share, can care for their elderly parents, where they're squeezed right now between trying to provide for their own children and trying now to look for the care of their adult, obviously their elderly parents. You know, that's the big squeeze. So they're just throwing everybody in long-term care, which is very expensive. It's an option, but an option should also be to try to keep them in aging in place in their home where it's going to be the most loving atmosphere.
So less long-term care Medicaid benefit for the elderly in New York if they have middle-class children? Is that what you're proposing?
I think we've got to look at options right now. No options are really available to those who are getting squeezed in the middle class. And, you know, there is massive fraud and waste. We know that. We've got to look at that. We've got to look at some of the long-term solutions, which are very expensive. Preventative care has to be part of the mix as well. I'm sorry if you can hear the rain. I'm in the car and going to Rochester, and it's pouring right now.
Never rains in New York City. And one more phone call before we run out of time with Rob Astorino, Republican candidate for governor of New York. Susan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Susan.
Thank you for taking my call. You've got a great program, and I love it. Really love it.
Thank you, ma'am.
My question is, why isn't Mr. Astorino pro-choice? Planned Parenthood says he isn't, and I have heard him speak, and he says he isn't. Why vote for someone who will not champion our need for legal abortion in New York State? We need to change the New York State law, modernize our law to protect legal abortion if the Supreme Court should either weaken or overturn Roe v. Wade, a real possibility.
That's the Women's Equality Act abortion rights item that wasn't able to get through the state senate, or that was part of it, to kind of pre-codify Roe's guarantees in case that goes away at the federal level. Mr. Estorino, what's your response?
Susan, thank you for the question. Yes, I have a different view than you do, but let's both deal with the reality of New York State. It's not going anywhere, abortion. It's used as a boogeyman by some, including Andrew Cuomo, to rile up the troops, to raise some money. Abortion is not going anywhere. It's codified in New York State. It is the law in New York State. It was the law 3 years before Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court is not going to take away and overturn Roe v. Wade. It's had that opportunity to even deal with it. It's chosen not to, with a very conservative court, by the way. So it's used as a boogeyman. If the question is, do I support the 10th plank of a 10-point plan for women's equality, I support 9 of them, as do the vast majority of legislators and people in New York. And let's do those. The 10th point is the most divisive. It is the most unpopular, even with pro-choicers. Pro-choicers, 75%, 76%, I think it is, of pro-choice New Yorkers say that the 10th plank is unacceptable. Legalizing abortion up to birth, on demand, unrestricted access, in health clinics, by the way, that are not even being inspected. How is that for women who have to make a tough choice on an abortion and go to an unsanitary, uninspected clinic? And part of the law, by the way, which would be changed, is taking the language out that requires abortions, especially the risky ones in third trimester, to be performed by non-doctors. That is, I think, very unhealthy. I think it is not pro-women, and I do not think that's going to be in line with most New Yorkers. So I would not agree to that plank. But let's be honest, abortion's not going anywhere in New York State. Despite my personal view, it's not going anywhere in New York State.
One follow-up on that, actually two very quick follow-ups on that. On the non-doctors, my understanding is that that pertains to licensed nurse practitioners who are picking – that's the highest level of nurse who are picking up an increasing number of responsibilities that traditionally only doctors performed. So there are already provisions under New York State law, my understanding is, where those practitioners can provide abortion. So it wouldn't be, we're taking abortion out of the hands of the only safe people to deliver them. Fair enough?
No, it's not fair at all. I do not want non-physicians performing high-risk third trimester surgery on women. We've seen what has happened in some cases. Why would we permit that? I mean, if women are going to have an abortion, I want to make sure that it's in a healthy clinic. It's in a clinic that has high standards, hygiene is inspected, so we know women are getting clean and good care. I do not want non-physicians performing these kind of abortions.
But even if that provision having to do with the doctors came out, if both houses of the legislature passed that abortion rights provision, would you veto it as governor?
I do not think that we should be expanding abortion up to birth on demand for basically any reason. I think society has spoken on this. The vast majority of people agree with me on this one. We have access like no other state for abortion in New York. To say that abortion by the stroke of a pen is going to go somewhere and it's going to become outlawed is ridiculous in New York. And it's just used by the few, like Andrew Cuomo, for pure political reasons. So he doesn't have to talk about why he's under investigation for corruption, so, why this state is just draining our own citizens to other states because nobody could afford it here, why it's the worst business climate, the worst state to retire in. And think about how many pro-choice women have had to leave New York to move to find a better job, or to move to be closer to their kids who have moved to find a better job.
So you would veto that bill if it came to you?
I would.
Last thing, and I wasn't going to bring it up, but since you brought it up and said that Cuomo wouldn't debate you one-on-one, You did reject our debate proposal because we're a radio, not a television station. Cuomo accepted. You can still come on. You want to do it?
I'd be more than happy to if Channel 4 televises. Channel 4 is a debate partner with WNYC, and I believe very strongly. Look, there were 5 proposals for TV debates, one-on-one. I accepted them all. The governor accepted none of them. Then out of the clear blue, we get one for Buffalo only with all the candidates, which is what the governor said was a disservice to democracy from 2010. And now out of the, you know, we have an opportunity to debate one-on-one. I'd be more than happy. Look, Brian, I come on your show every time I'm invited. Yep. I went on and did it with Zephyr Teachout because I thought it was very important. But the fact that the governor wants a radio-only debate at 10 in the morning, where he may not even show up because he could do it as I'm doing it right now by telephone and not permit television cameras in there, is not a service to the voters of New York. So if WNYC and Channel 4, their partner, wants to have a televised live debate, I'd be more than happy to do it.
Well, our partner, the governor, just to be clear, because I don't want to misrepresent, our partner is the Wall Street Journal, but I've never hosted a radio debate that television stations didn't cover as a news story.
Correct.
So we will...
And the governor will not permit TV cameras in there to cover it as a news story. That was his demand.
Well, I don't know. Maybe we can still get him to change that. But anyway, Rob Astorino, Republican gubernatorial candidate in New York State. Thank you very much for giving us this much time. We really appreciate it, and we will talk.
Brian, anytime. Thank you so much.
This is Sarah in Atlanta.
This is Mike Finnegan in North Carolina.
This is Adriana in Richmond, Virginia.
You're listening to 25 Years.
You're listening to 25 Years.
In 25 Days.
On WNYC.
Today, it's 2001.
It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
Surrounding the collapse of Enron to determine what went so horribly wrong.
The plane, which was headed for the Dominican Republic, crashed just south of Kennedy Airport.
I think that Mark has been a good public advocate. His skills are to go and to find problems. My skills are to go and solve them.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
In 2001... UN Secretary General Kofi Annan won the Nobel Peace Prize. A Beautiful Mind won Best Picture at the Oscars. Tony for Best Play, Proof by David Auburn. The Pulitzer Prize for Fiction went to The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. And some of the books that made it to number one on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list were Before 9/11, An Hour Before Daylight by Jimmy Carter, Foley is Good by pro wrestler Jim Foley, Napalm and Silly Putty by comedian George Carlin, the John Adams biography by historian David McCullough, and Seabiscuit by Laura Hillenbrand. Then after 9/11, Germs by Judith Miller about bioterrorism, The No Spin Zone by Bill O'Reilly, Straight from the Gut by CEO of GE Jack Welch, and a special book-size edition of Life magazine called One Nation. And in 2001, New York City was not done in by terrorism.
When people endure a traumatic event, one of two things happens. They either become almost immobilized by it, or beaten by it, or crushed by it, or they grow, from it. And on the evening of September 11th, I asked the people of New York, I think it may have been my last or second to last statement that I made at the third press conference that we had, and we were all pretty exhausted and probably in shock, right? Probably still in shock. I said, I want the people of New York City to emerge stronger for this. And I remember thinking as I walked off the podium that I wasn't sure if that was an exhortation, an admonition, or a prayer, because I wasn't sure that we'd emerge stronger for it. I thought we would. I hoped that we would.
Former Mayor Rudy Giuliani, looking back 10 years later.
I had this essential faith that the people of New York City handle big things much better than small things. You know, if there's a pothole or you don't get rid of the first 3 inches of snow, they want to impeach you. But if there's a train wreck or a blackout, or they just rise to the occasion. And the people of New York really did rise to the occasion. They've been stronger and better than I even thought they would be. New York City, just focus now on New York City, which after all was the center of the largest attack. New York City now has more people living there. New York City has more tourists. New York City is economically sounder, even with the recession and the problems that we're having now in our economy. New York City's economy is not as affected as the rest of the country. It's a more diverse economy.
Rudy Giuliani at the National Press Club in September of 2011. You know, the way that we're producing this 25 Years and 25 Day series, the producers and I sit around and brainstorm year by year. What should we single out for a then and now treatment for 1998, for 1999? Well, for 2001, there was no discussion. It's so obvious, duh, that we would have to and would want to acknowledge 9/11. But with what angle? And what guests? We've been having all these pretty big names come on for the different years. But for 2001, we decided no outside guests. You are the guests, because 9/11 and the aftermath for this show and really for the whole area were about us all getting through it together. And the questions that seemed to bubble up for us at this point were, if you lived here before 9/11, what has changed and what hasn't changed in the New York area as a result? You heard Rudy Giuliani, I think, at his best in that National Press Club speech, talking about the resiliency of New York and what turned out not to have changed. How about for you? 212-433-WNYC. And if you moved here after 9/11, as so many people have, I think I saw a stat that like a third of the city came here after 9/11, so we'll assume it's in seven figures. Why did you move to a city with a bullseye on its back? And is post 9/11 New York the city you expected to find? 212-433-9692. Again, if you lived here before 9/11, what has changed and what hasn't changed in the New York area as a result? You have to include a what hasn't changed item in your answer. 212-433-9692. And if you did move here after 9/11, as so many people have, why did you move to a city with a bullseye on its back? Did it give you pause? And is post 9/11 New York the city you expected to find? 212-433-9692. As I said, we don't have outside guests, but we do have my WNYC colleague, Karen Frillman, here to help take your calls. Karen is WNYC's enterprise editor and a special producer of this 25 Years in 25 Days series. She's been guiding coverage of the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks for the station ever since she joined our news department a few months after those attacks. Hi, Karen.
Morning.
A usually behind-the-scenes force at WNYC sitting with me at the microphone, because she's been so involved in this over the years. And I'll just jump in with one thing that did not change. Lower Manhattan continued to become a hot real estate market. In fact, it became even more of one. It was happening before 9/11, some of you will remember. But afterwards, when I would come to work down here, because our old studios were just a few blocks away, we actually evacuated after the attacks, and I would see the smoldering ruins day after day, month after month. At the beginning, I thought this neighborhood is doomed. It'll be seen as too dangerous or too sad. But the opposite happened. Karen, as you know, government incentives helped, but that couldn't do it by itself.
Absolutely. You go down to Tribeca and Lower Manhattan, and it is incredibly vibrant. It's a new part of New York. It doesn't look exactly like the rest of New York because it's so contemporary in many places, and it just has incredible street life. It's cafe society all summer.
You want to throw one on the fire here, something that has changed and something that hasn't changed?
Well, it feels to me like going into buildings, you know, coming into this building every day or going into, you know, many, many buildings in New York City now, you need to show identification. You need to have a security pass. And I think the sense of the ubiquitous security guard everywhere is something that was not a part of New York City, you know, before 9/11. I think that we are very much aware now that you know, how you enter a place, you're going to be checked out in many places.
I want to play a clip of the author Salman Rushdie from this show back in 2002. Oh, wait. So that's what has changed. Do you want to do a hasn't? You're required to have a hasn't changed item.
Well, what hasn't changed when I think about being in New York after September 11th, what so many of us experienced was the tremendous tenderness that we had towards each other and how we made eye contact with each other. And people stopped you on the street. There was so much intimacy. And we thought, my goodness, it transformed the city in that way. And now, I mean, you just get jostled on the subway. There's a tremendous sense that the individual, who can move faster, who can move, you know, stronger.
Good old New York back to the way it was. Although, I don't know. We could have a debate about this. Because I actually think, at least for people who were here then, that did change permanently a little bit in the direction of people just being more civil to each other. That, at least for people who were here on 9/11, we all have a little more of a sense of our own mortality and that things could happen to us at any moment without warning, that I think has softened the vibe of the city a little bit.
Well, there is a sense that we lost our innocence, you know, that in a way we are aware of our vulnerability. I agree. But I don't know, on the interpersonal, maybe it's just that I'm, you know, 13 years older, so I feel that sense of just how physically aggressive the city is. And if you're not moving fast enough, you're going to get run over.
And doing my duty to throw on some things that have changed, there are surveillance cameras everywhere. Flying sucks in a way that it didn't before, even worse. Ordinary peaceful Muslims or anyone who looks like they might be Muslim are looked at with more suspicion than before. I think that's changed. I want to play a clip of the author Salman Rushdie from this show back in 2002, just the next year after the attacks. And remember that in 1989, Rushdie had been given a death sentence by the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran for writing his book, The Satanic Verses, which was critical of Islam. Rushdie grew up Muslim in India, but he still got this bullseye of a fatwa on his bar, India and UK, I guess. But he still got this bullseye of a fatwa on his back from radical Islam. And he talked on our show in 2002 about how that experience informed his adjustment to life in New York after 9/11.
Something happened to me that was so strange and unexpected and took and, you know, really cast a shadow over almost a decade of my life. And, I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me, seeing what happened in New York after 9/11, is that it seemed as if people were coming to a very similar conclusion that I had, which was that in the end, no matter how scary the world is, no matter how disturbing it is, you have to put your concerns about that into a little box and put them in the corner and get on with your day, because fear is something which paralyzes. And it becomes impossible to get on with things. It becomes impossible to make clear choices and so on. And I think one of the things that's been, and I had to learn that. I had to learn that if you're going to just get on with your life, the issue of fear has to be set aside in some way. Otherwise, you can't function. And it's been really interesting to me and heartening in New York in this past year to see the city coming back to itself with that kind of recognition. You know, and to give an example of that, if you recall a few months ago when there was a scare surrounding the Brooklyn Bridge, mm-hmm. And from what I've begun to think of as the Ministry of False Alarms, and instead of the reaction which would have obtained even 3 or 4 months earlier when people would have been scared and worried that, you know, here it comes again, the reaction that I observed in the city that day was really irritation. You know, don't shut my bridge on me. And I thought that was a good thing. I thought it was a way of people coming to terms with the fact that maybe the world does have now some alarming, even frightening aspects, but that doesn't stop you leading your life.
All right, Salman Rushdie on this program in 2002. Listeners, did it take you a while to come to that same conclusion as Rushdie did? If you moved to New York after 9/11, did you have to grapple with that question in advance? 212-433-WNYC 433-9692. And we'll get your calls in just a second about what changed, mostly what didn't change about New York after 9/11. And if you came here after that date, why did you move to a city with a bullseye on its back? 212-433-9692. 9692. But Karen Froman, our enterprise editor, special producer on this 25 Years in 25 Days series, our kind of lead producer on the aftermath of 9/11, just about ever since 9/11. What were you thinking as you listened to Salman Rushdie?
Well, I think that he is right. And of course, what was lucky for us in a way was there was that singular attack, and then we were able to rebuild and get back to our, you know, being New Yorkers and just get back to our lives with a deep, deep sense of appreciation. I think now about, you know, people in war zones, and I feel it's made me much more sensitive to what it's like in a tiny way to understand what it must be like to be in a war zone. And I think that if it's the day after day after day where that fear must, where it's much harder to deal with that. But in what we had the experience, we were able to come together, and in many ways it did make us feel like, let's live this life.
George in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you thinking?
Well, I've lived here all my life. I was at the World Trade Center when the building went down, and actually I was rescued. I was on the 55th floor of the North Tower, and the firemen got me out. My father was a fireman, and I think that the fire department did a tremendous job, and that's what hasn't changed here in New York. We have an incredible superstructure with the fire department and with people that are dedicated in helping us survive. But the place was pretty dirty for a long time, and what I found that's changed about the city with the Skyway and with Central Park has really blossomed. We have a lot more greenery here than we had before, so there's indications of life. And now we're talking about, you know, creating even more parks and more greenery, and I think that's fantastic. That's really something to look forward to.
George, thank you. Thank you very much. Matthew in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Were you here before 9/11? Matthew? Matthew once, Matthew twice. Michael in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to say what has not changed from New York City since 9/11 is that New York City still is a target of terrorism and extremism, as we see in 2009 with the subway plot and the 2010 Times Square plot. What has changed, to what the producer was saying earlier, sadly, is the month following 9/11, the spirit of unity that was felt by New Yorkers in New York City with us waving flags and being a witness together. And then partly because we want to get back to our normal, quote-unquote, lives, it faded away to where, okay, now we go back to way how New Yorkers are. Move, move, move. You have to go to here, to there. Life has to go on because there has been, I mean, there still is a struggle of the families and the people who experienced and were affected by 9/11 and traumatized by it.
Of course.
They want a mourning. Other side says, no, it happened. Okay, we have to move on and not let the terrorists win and not stay, you know, mourning for 9/11 forever.
You know, those are great points. And I wonder for you as somebody, it sounds like you have maybe a greater than average awareness of the potential for terrorism at every moment. I'm just getting that as a first impression for what you said. Do you avoid transit hubs or anything like that because you have an extra dash of caution in your day-to-day behavior, or not really?
Absolutely not. I am a New Yorker born and raised, and I've lived before 9/11 and after 9/11, and if someone paid me $1 billion, I still wouldn't move out of New York City. It's my home. I love it. Go Mets. I do not avoid the subways or hubs or special events. I've been going out. I'm going to Manhattan today, and I refuse to give in to fear. That's not how a great people or a great country lived.
You said go Mets. Michael from Queens, you triggered a memory. I actually happened to be holding tickets that I had already had for what turned out to be the first Major League Baseball game, and it was a Mets game, played in New York after the 9/11 attacks. If I recall correctly, it was a Friday night, and at Shea, they had security, of course, like nobody had ever seen before at a ball game in New York. And there was this palpable fear among those of us in the crowd. What could happen tonight? This was the first time that 50,000 people were getting together in one place in New York since the attacks. It certainly would have been a perfect target if somebody had made it one or succeeded in making one. But we all had that spirit that you just articulated, Michael. Like, we are New Yorkers. We are not leaving. We're coming to cheer on our Mets. We're coming to live our lives walking through the security gate and gathering en masse in Flushing Meadows. So thank you for triggering that memory.
And I remember the Yankees made it to the World Series that year, remember? And nobody thought they would. And that was an also amazingly emotional end of season.
And, you know, I got to go to one of those playoff games. And I have a story from that, too, which talk about whether the country came together, whether the city came together. How about whether the country came together? The playoff game that I got to go to turned out to be on one of the nights that President Bush gave one of his early speeches about how we're going to go to Afghanistan, we're going to find those guys, we're going to get them dead or alive, they can't run, they can't hide. And the crowd, a lot of the crowd, started chanting, USA, 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 like we were all together as these Americans. And they delayed the start of the game to let the Bush speech finish, and people are chanting, USA, USA. And then the speech finished, and the public address announcer gets on, who was still Bob Shepard then, and said, now the lineup for the Oakland Athletics, for Oakland. Boo! So 30 seconds after it was USA, US, Oakland, Oakland, boo! So then I knew life was back to normal. Michael in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you? Okay. The one thing that has not changed is the ever-increasing amount of police abuse from the NYPD towards law-abiding people. And not just people of color, but also women, as we've seen lately, and even Caucasian women. I cannot forget how NYPD takes a Latino woman, a pregnant Latino woman, and throws her down to the ground, face down, stomach down, and she is one of many pregnant women that have felt the abuse of NYPD.
Well, and Michael, thank you. I'm going to leave it there. And without getting into, you know, particular grievances against the NYPD, I think this actually raises an interesting notion of change and consistency. And I think Michael was using this kind of, you know, as a hook to air his grievances against the police department. But there was that moment, Karen, and the other caller talked about the fire department. There was that moment when people who didn't give much of a thought to them in general really started to appreciate how fighters and also police officers, because plenty of them died on 9/11, put their life on the line every day. It's still there, I think, with the firefighters, this extra reverence that people have, if they were here at the time, when they walk by any firehouse. With the NYPD, as Michael reflects, it has gone back to the contentious relationship between communities and the police. Sometimes we see what happened with Stop and Frisk, and now even now with Bratton.
I agree. I think that's absolutely right, because I think for those of us who did grow up in New York and we had a long arc to watch the way that the NYPD interacted in communities, and there wasn't always that feeling that there were very mixed feelings. And I think after the attacks, there was just such a sense of a bond between the people and the NYPD. And I think you're right. That has not stayed.
History resumed. Because it was just 2 years earlier, 1999, that Amadou Diallo, the innocent guy, was killed in the Bronx. And there was the same kind of outpouring of outrage that we're seeing in Ferguson now, that we saw over Stop and Frisk, that we saw over the Sean Bell police killing in the mid-2000s, and, you know, pressure to change the policy of what was then called the Street Crimes Unit. And that went away briefly after 9/11, and then it came back. One more. Hillary moved here since 9/11. Hi, Hillary.
Hi. Hey, thanks. I have to say I love listening to you, and thanks for listening to me today. I was in D.C. And had been there for many years from after school as a journalist, reporter, producer. I did Shark Week for Discovery Channel and all that stuff. And I had a piece that I was going into post-production to edit down by the Pentagon. It was about a quarter mile, half mile away on Washington Boulevard on the same side that the plane hit. And so, and I'm kind of moving toward my move to New York, which was 5 years ago, but the upshot was that all the glass blew out. And so my editor, ironically Bill, and I'm Hillary, and at the time, you know, it was ironic, and I'm friends with his wife, so I can say that with aplomb. The upshot was that he said, don't come down here. So, of course, we sit there in shock, and I quite frankly think all of us in the district, which was ground zero there, and our nation capital and here had PTSD for weeks, and I had just left a marriage where my husband came back from Gulf One and he had it, so I know what it looks like. I know how it feels.
I think for a lot of New Yorkers, hearing a plane fly low, I had this for a while because I heard it. I was there. We were six blocks away.
I would like duck. And I was in combat zones as an ABC reporter. I mean, yeah. Exactly. I mean, you're just like looking over your shoulder.
So having lived in both D.C. and New York, the two cities that were the targets of the attack primarily, did you find a difference between the two cities after you moved here?
Absolutely. Well, and this is what I was getting to, is that my husband's a New Yorker, Westchester boy, but kind of grew up in the city. And my dad's from, you know, basically Hell's Kitchen. I mean, he's a big Irishman who ended up after Korea in San Francisco, which is how I came along. But the upshot is in moving to, you know, having lived on both coasts and in the district, you know, after the attacks and then coming here, I really thought that my early impressions as a child visiting here was that everybody was rude and that, as an earlier caller said, you were going to get run over if you didn't move fast enough. And, you know, being a left coaster, that was kind of intimidating. So I had some reservations, but for various reasons, 5 years ago, we moved here and started a family business and kind of got closer to a family here. And I left my community. I left my home and some of my family members and really thought that I'd hate it. And what I've come to now, go Yankees, my dad's a lifelong fan, is that, you know, New York is home now, and I've fallen in love with this state, and the people are amazing and big-hearted and resilient, and that's been a good thing.
That's been a good thing, and it sounds like New York is really lucky to have you among its members.
So.
Hillary, thank you very much for calling in. Hang in
there. Both of you for having the show today. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye. I will throw in one last thing that didn't change after 9/11. New Yorkers were still and are still more anti-war than the rest of the country, despite my Yankee Stadium story. I remember in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2002, 2003, the polls still showed New Yorkers were more opposed to the idea of the war than other Americans, perhaps because we're less xenophobic, trigger-happy to identify the other broadly and go get them. I had at the time, and I think I said it on the air, Brian's theory of inverse World Trade Center bloodlust. The closer people lived to the World Trade Center, the less likely we were to chant USA, USA, and want to go off bombs a-blazing. That's just my theory. But I think it had mostly to do with New York diversity sensibilities.
And I also think it was that we witnessed violence and I think understood that it was not, many of us, a way to solve problems, that it didn't bring people closer together.
WNYC Enterprise Editor Karen Froman, who oversees so much of the great work that our news department does, usually behind the scenes. She's been our lead producer on the aftermath of 9/11 just about ever since, and is a special producer for this 25 Years and 25 Days series. Karen, thanks for joining me for this.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you.
Tomorrow, 2002, it's the year the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal really became public knowledge. We'll do a then and now take on that. And we go out, as we've been doing every day, with the Billboard number one song of the year for 2001. It was Hanging by a Moment by Lifehouse.
Take your love me now. Find even more.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and if you zip down 2nd Avenue or across Fordham Road on the MTA's Select bus service, the ones where you pay before you get on and they don't make every stop, you can thank my next guest. Jaime Lerner is credited with putting in place the first bus rapid transit system when he was mayor of Curitiba, Brazil in the 1970s, and his revolutionary idea for a low-cost, low-infrastructure way of making surface transit act more like a subway system has spread to 126 cities around the world. That's what can happen when an architect and urban planner gets elected mayor. He's here now to talk about his book, Urban Acupuncture, now in an English translation. Welcome to the station, Mayor Lerner.
All right. Thank you.
Urban acupuncture, defined on the cover as pinpricks of change that enrich city life. So finding the trigger points that can have a larger effect?
Yes. Sometimes in many cities of the world, planning takes time. Lot of bureaucracy, and we don't realize how a pinprick or a focused idea can provide a new energy for the city. So we shouldn't wait. We should do it immediately. And that it's not instead of the process of planning. It's to help the process of planning. So there's many ideas all over the world. Here, many examples that they could change positively for a city, and they can make people more happy.
Small things, pinpricks that make a big difference, urban acupuncture. And your book isn't an urban planning textbook, we should say. It's more about your sharing some of those pinpricks that you've seen in your home country of Brazil and in your travels around the world. You want to give us another example, any one that you want to pick?
Yes. Here in New York, the High Line. Again, in New York, the bicycle paths, but they changed the city, bringing back the bicycle. So they transform, in some ways, an individual transport and a public transport. Other good pinprick, the ferry. But I'll give
in
you
New York, you mean more ferry service? Of course, Staten Island Ferry is old, and there are newer ferry services.
Of course.
To New Jersey, to Queens, that kind of thing.
We have to use more than the water. We don't have to be afraid of the water. And one of the best systems of transport in the world is in Venice, the Vaporetto. You know how much time it takes to board and to leave the Vaporetto? Between 5 and 10 seconds. It's faster than a subway. And, you know, with big waves, and they have to deal, and they can do it. So why not more and more vaporetos here in New York?
That's ferries, right? Portuguese for ferries?
It's different. The ferry takes cars, it's more heavy. A vaporetto is it's more light. And it can be operated very easily. You can board quickly.
Listeners, questions for our guest, former mayor, Jaime Lerner, from Brazil, 212-433-WNYC, or examples that you want to throw out from any city that you've ever visited of the pinpricks that can bring big changes to the quality of life in cities, 212-433-9692. I will mention that Mayor Lerner will be speaking tonight at the Museum of the City of New York on Lessons from Brazil, and afterwards in conversation with former New York City Transportation Commissioner Jeanette Sadiq Khan, some of the ideas she put in place obviously influenced well, at least along the same lines of what you're talking about, the bus rapid transit, the bike lanes, very associated with Jeanette Sadiq Khan when she was transportation commissioner under Bloomberg. Did the city consult with you in planning those projects?
No, but Jeanette, she did a wonderful work. She has the credit because she's a very tough woman, and she could do it in a city always centered in the car, and she was brilliant. So there is other examples in many other cities, sometimes very simple, very simple.
From the city of Shanghai, you use trees as an example.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's a big city, and sometimes you feel uncomfortable in such a big city. But sometimes they have trees in some streets every 3 meters, and they are having their clothes hanging in the streets. But the trees are a beautiful acupuncture. And also sometimes, I have in my city one dentist. After practicing the whole day on Friday afternoon, when he finished his work, he gives a concert in the window of a clarinet. So, and the people are waiting. This guy is making his city better.
But is he any good?
Yeah, he's good. So every time you can find people that they can make brilliant, and it's not, sometimes money interferes too much. So if you want creativity, cut 10 from your budget. If you want sustainability, cut 2 zeros. But if you want solidarity, you have to keep your own identity and respect others' diversity.
Nora in Brooklyn Heights, you're on WNYC with Maya Lerner. Hi.
Hi. I completely I'm going to go buy the book. I love what the author is saying. And I just wanted to give an example that I've been experiencing, which is in the last several years, have been appearing these sort of lime green tables and chairs in public spaces, some of which used to be traffic lanes. And it's just really wonderful to see how people just gravitate to them and just sit and enjoy a beautiful day. Whereas before, I don't know where they would have been, you know, leaning on a scaffolding or something. But in Brooklyn, we have Borough Hall Plaza, which used to just be empty. And now during the nice months, during the daytime hours, it's filled up with these green tables and chairs, and people bring their lunch and sit outside and enjoy the day.
Nice one, Nora. Thank you very much. And Tom in Scotch Plains has an example from Bangkok, I think. Hi, Tom. You're on WNYC.
Yes, hi. One of the best ways I found of traveling when I was in Bangkok just a month ago was by canal boat on what they call the Klongs, the canals there in Bangkok. And as your guest stated, it's very easy to get on and off those canal boats. They pull up to the pier, and in a matter of seconds, people would pour on to the boat, and others would come off, and the boat would take off, and the wake would slosh around there in the canal. But people sat down and pulled up the screens, and off we went. So it was very easy to get going there by canal boat, very quick and efficient mode of transportation there.
Tom, thanks a lot for that. We've just got a minute or two left. One more example from your book, Seoul, the city of Seoul, South Korea, reclaimed a river.
Yes.
That's their pinprick that brought greater change.
Great work. They restored the river, the Chungcheong River, and it's become, it was packed with traffic and freeways, and they removed and they could bring back life and the streams and the story of the city.
The what river?
Chungcheong.
It's worth reviving just so we can say it. Just so we can say it more times.
Sugar chum.
And final thing, this is conceptually very interesting, and I think it's different than what we see in most places. You prescribe balance, bringing commerce to residential neighborhoods,
yes,
or residences to office parks. And I think where people want to live, by and large, other than, you know, the street life commerce of local merchants,
yes,
we want to be separated from that.
That's terrible. I think every time when you separate living from work or from – a city is a structure of living, working, and moving together. And every time when you don't have housing, you have to bring – the best acupuncture is people, is children. And – every idea, I love the idea how to teach children about their city. Can you imagine every class of children, they can bring some ideas and what that could make this city much better. This city, which I love because the diversity, it's really, and that brings creativity, opportunity.
And we're glad you're here today. Jaime Lerner's new book is Urban Acupuncture, Celebrating Pinpricks of Change That Enrich City Life. He will be at the Museum of the City of New York tonight at 6:30, where he will present lessons from Brazil, after which he'll be joined by former Department of Transportation Commissioner Jeanette Sada Khan and urbanist Roberta Brandes-Gratz for a community conversation. By the way, tickets are free to museum members, Museum of the City of New York members, or can be purchased through their website. We have a link at wnyc.org/shows/BL.
May I offer an acupuncture to New York?
Please.
It's the steam of the subway. So in special days, having the steams of the subway colored, for instance, in your anniversary, or some important dates.
They do it now with the top of the Empire State Building lights. They could do it with steam.
Steam is more beautiful.
All right. A little dessert, an additional urban acupuncture recommendation from Jaime Lerner. Thank you very much.
You.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll dip into the WNYC series, Climate 2050. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and you should expect thunderstorms in our area tonight and rain tomorrow and much more wet weather in the year 2050. As you heard this morning on WNYC, if you were listening, heavy rainstorms, the kinds that cause flooding and burden the city sewer system, will be more common in the next few decades. It's one of the effects of climate change that is expected to make living in the city very different. WNYC and NBC4 New York have partnered on a series called NYC 2050, looking at these effects on our area, from warmer summers and more stress on the power grid to more rain and in our sewer system, and more than that, too. So we have in our studio somebody who you've probably seen. People meet me and they say, oh, there's the face behind the voice. Well, now we're going to hear the voice behind the face. Janice Huff, meteorologist for Channel 4, NBC4 New York, joins me in the studio. Hi, Janice.
Hi there, Brian. Nice to see you.
Welcome to radio.
Thank you.
And Matthew Sherman, WNYC editor and reporter on this series. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Brian.
So, Janice, the series looks at a year that's really not that far off in a way, 2050.
Sure.
Why then? And can you paint us a picture of the kind of weather we're likely to be seeing in just 36 years?
Well, I think we sort of went in the middle of an average of span of when the climate projections were predicting when we might reach a certain threshold in terms of passing a certain point of, like, no return, I guess you could say. And so 2050 was sort of kind of in the middle there of what the climate might be like mid-century across the area, around the area, around the world, and particularly here. And what climate scientists are are saying now is the basis of all of this, of course, is the fact that, you know, it's not so much that climate change, when it will happen, and what's coming, and it's happened already. It's happening now. And how will we handle it and deal with it in terms of our, you know, personal lives, local governments, infrastructure, nations, and the world at large? So in terms of weather itself, the projections, as long as things stay on track, it appears that we'll have heavier rainstorms because of increased water vapor due to increased carbon dioxide in, emissions in the atmosphere. Increased water vapor, which means more of those torrential downpours kind of rainstorms, like the ones we saw on Long Island this past summer where they got like 15 inches of rain in a very short period of time.
Is that more of a tropical pattern?
Well, it you would see more of that in the tropics. Not here, or not in a lot of places. Duluth, Minnesota also had a similar situation this summer where they saw intense flooding in a very short period of time as well. They had record rainfall, same kind of thing that happened on Long Island. So, yes, it's more tropical in nature. But then again, as the planet warms up, you know, that's the kind of thing you would see, more tropical types of situations in places that you normally wouldn't see them.
So, Matthew Sherman, another way to put this that I see you've been using for the series to describe heat is that New York City, quote, will feel like Birmingham, Alabama in the year 2050. That's a pretty graphic comparison if it's really accurate. So WNYC engineer Wayne Schulmeister, for example, who's from Birmingham, traveled down there this August. I guess he got a company-paid trip home, since this was a reporting trip, I don't know, to ask people.
Not so sure about that.
To ask
I think
people,
he got a day's pay. Is what
a day's pay. Okay. So to ask people there about the summers and what New Yorkers can expect, and here's a clip.
Summertime, Alabama slows down. Everybody just kind of goes their own speed. The whole state slows down in August and September.
Carry some deodorant with you wherever you go and drink a lot of water.
And definitely understand that everybody's going to be in an ill mood. Everybody's more inclined to be aggravated easier, agitated.
How do you cope with the heat?
Meditation.
I drank a lot of fluid. Drank water, Gatorade, and sometimes I just stay in my truck, you know, and sit down for a minute, you know.
Is this all about global warming?
It is.
I don't believe it.
And Brian, if I can just jump in there and tell you a bit about the background for this series, is that there is this thing called the New York City Panel on Climate Change, which was invented by Mayor Bloomberg, and they are a group of esteemed scientists from regional research institutions, Columbia, Princeton, Stevens Institute of Technology, et cetera, and they basically took climate models that the UN uses for, or rather the International Climate the International Panel on Climate Change uses for global predictions, and they came up with some projections for New York City in the 2020s, 2050s, and 2080s. And they really came up with a range of projections because there's a lot of uncertainty when you look forward in the future, but we took the midpoint of those ranges, and they say that there will be 45 days on average every summer in the 2050s at or above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's close to what Birmingham has today. That compares to 18 days, which New York City currently experiences. So it's about 2.5 times what we are currently experiencing.
And we only had 2 days, I think, over 90 this past summer, yeah, which probably gave people a false sense of security. But I've read, Janice, and I've mentioned it on the air, and you must know it as a TV meteorologist, that it was actually the hottest year on record globally.
Yes.
We just happened to be in a cool spot.
We happened to be in a cool spot. And California was in a hot spot. I mean, they're working on their warmest, possibly warmest year ever. They're definitely their warmest September ever. So, yeah, I think what happens is when you live in your own, you know, local area, you tend to just focus on what happens locally, and you have to see what's going on everywhere else, and you sort of balance it out.
So I want to play a clip from your piece, Janice, about the predictions, the midpoint of what the, you know, International Panel of Scientists predicts that Matt was referring to. This is Dr. Ben Strauss of Climate Central, who you spoke to by the East River.
Historically, most of the storms in New York City haven't been very damaging from a storm surge perspective. Think of them a little bit like Danny DeVito. So Sandy was Shaquille O'Neal. But sea level rise can turn Danny DeVito into Michael Jordan.
I loved that analogy. You definitely painted a picture for you.
The Hollywood basketball transformation. Yeah. So as a meteorologist, how are you already seeing effects like this one or the frequency of heavy rainstorms as you report on the weather?
Well, like I said, the incident that we saw in Long Island this past summer, it was certainly a signal there for us. We've seen an increase of a lot of different things other than like intense rainfall, but we've seen intense rainfall setups in other parts of the country and the world as well. Increased isolated amounts of heavy rain that seem to come out of nowhere and flood areas that might not typically flood. What's going to happen? Ben Strauss is an expert on sea level rise, and what they are saying is with the sea level rise of 1.5 feet, give or take, you know, a foot maybe, or half a foot in some instances, that even the most minor storm, I mean, Sandy was an exception. You know, Sandy was like a Shaquille O'Neal in terms of a storm. But you could get a run-of-the-mill coastal storm. It doesn't even have to be as large as Sandy, but with the sea level rise that's anticipated, you could still have the type of damage of a Sandy with a smaller storm. And so that's what we are looking more at and in terms of paying more attention to just every storm, not just one particular storm that comes.
And which is also why adaptation to these likely future conditions and not just prevention seems to be more and more in the public policy conversation.
Right.
So, Matthew, in your piece earlier this week on heat and in this morning's piece on rain from WNYC's Stephen Nesson in the Climate 2050 series, you both talked about a part of the city that's all around us and which seems to pose a major problem, and that's concrete. So here's a clip of WNYC's Stephen Nesson from his piece this morning on rain, and then we'll hear about heat from Stuart Gaffin from Columbia University. Listen.
The water is spilling over. An inch of rain from 6 billion square feet of impervious surface is filling the sewers every time there's a heavy downpour. The problem is, once all this rain goes down the storm drain, it mixes with the city's sewage. And every year, an average of 27 billion gallons of combined stormwater and sewage is dumped directly into our waterways.
If you stand on the side of this roof and you look sideways, you'll see the heat schlering off. It's the Schlieren effect. What does that mean? You're not going to sleep very well. You're going to sleep fitfully. You're going to be tired the next day, more stress from the daytime heat, more sweating. You come home at night, God, I can't cool off again. You know, your body can really build up a lot of stress over those few days, and that is indeed one of the risk factors.
Ooh, vocabulary word. Schlieren.
Schlieren.
I never heard that before.
He's basically using it to describe that image that you see on a hot summer's day, the sort of waviness of the sky just above a very hot surface. And it's proof positive that when sunlight hits concrete or asphalt or pavement, that the hard surface there retains the heat and gives it off slowly, intensifies the heat in a way, because it is dark usually, in a way that grass does not, for example, because grass is a living organism and actually breathes and cools off by the way we cool off, which is it perspires.
So heat is colorless, odorless, and tasteless, but you can see it sometimes.
Sometimes. Yeah, you can.
I guess if it's really intense, it affects the light waves in some sort of way.
And about the concrete, the city expects to spend $2.5 billion, that's billion with a B, I see, dollars over the next 20 years on green infrastructure, but it won't go far enough, even that, to deal with rain. It would only take 1 inch of rain off of 10% of the city's surfaces. Mm-hmm. Bloomberg's own numbers from that climate panel?
Yes. The DEP, I should say, the Department of Environmental Protection, thinks that that will go far enough at least to comply with the Clean Water Act, but it certainly doesn't sound like much, does it? $2.5 billion, and then that sort of gives you a sense of the scale of adaptation that we need and the amount of money. You spend $2.5 billion in something, and all you're doing is cutting down on the stormwater runoff from 10% of your surfaces.
I just want to mention before we run out of time that the data news team here at WNYC has put together a grid for people to map your sentiments on climate change and what can be done to prepare the city for 2050. It's up on our website, so listeners can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show to participate in this sentiments data map. Can you walk us through it?
A lot of people, right, basically it's a grid. It's sort of like the New York Magazine highbrow, lowbrow grid, and you basically fill in a square, say that you are very concerned about climate change or you don't think it's serious, you're doing a lot or you're not doing a lot. We're seeing a lot of people in the upper right-hand quadrant there saying they think climate change is serious. They are doing something, but they really wish they did more.
Mm-hmm. Are people seeing this on Channel 4 as well as hearing
it
on the radio?
Yeah, same thing. We have, you know, people with mixed emotions, but most people are basically saying that they are concerned and they want to know what more they can do, definitely.
Right. Mm-hmm. Are you doing TV packages on this?
We are, and we have Andrew Siff's package tonight talking about the subway systems and the runoff and the rain and what the city's doing to
help
with that.
Is that in the 6 o'clock news?
That's in the 5:30.
5:30.
Yeah.
And we will leave it there with Janice Huff, meteorologist on NBC4 New York. Let's see, I think that's Channel 4 on Time Warner, 4 on Comcast, 4 on DirecTV.
It's 4.
And if you don't have any kind of service, just you have antennas, it's Channel 4. That's what it is. Thanks a lot, Janice.
Thank you so much.
And WNYC's Matthew Sherman. Find out more about the series at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for Climate 2050.